everyone. It is Monday, January 13th. My God, this weekend. This weekend was nuts. Let me just tell you, it was like Acapulco out there. I wanted to, like, you know, get into a bathing suit and sunbathe. It was like 67 degrees in the middle of the winter. I know there's such a thing, everyone, as the January thaw, but trust me. Anyway, this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Ken Barnes is, I believe, on the border between Texas and Mexico, and he is there. We are going to be surrounded by a whole group of wonderful people filling in for Ken today. So I want to thank Fred Portnoy, who is our engineer, because he's training everyone. So thank you so much, Fred, for doing this. Today is, of course, our Rethink the Week. But actually, it was interesting. Fred sent me a note. And the note he sent me over the weekend was about the idea of carbon taxes and what to do with carbon taxes. And I said to him, there are good approaches to a carbon tax, okay approaches to carbon taxes, and not such good things for carbon taxes. And one of the reasons I was talking about that is that the French did the worst thing you could do for carbon taxes. So they implemented a carbon tax, and people, especially in rural France, were apoplectic. And the reason was they're already spending so much for their diesel, and suddenly they were being awarded a tax on what they're already spending. They've seen their incomes go flat. They weren't going to benefit from mass transit because they're living in rural France. And so they saw only the liability of a carbon tax and none of the benefit. Well, I believe it is either in British Columbia or Vancouver in Canada, they also implemented a carbon tax, but they used every dime of the carbon tax and they actually reinvested it in their community. And I think they actually did it in a progressive way. So the poorer you were, the bigger you, sort of dividend you got from the carbon tax, so that the tax was a way and an incentive for people to begin to reevaluate how they could use this newfound cash that was, one, a pressure on them because of maybe the gas-guzzling vehicles they were using, and maybe they could use it as a way to begin to weatherize their house, as a way they could use it to look at alternative vehicles, yada, yada, yada. So, but the most recent article I just read was really interesting, and they suggested that if we want to implement a carbon tax, then maybe we need to figure out what would be the best way to sell it. And what this article suggested, everyone, was that we give the money to the next generation, that the money be used for children, so that it's being used to improve their education. It's being used to improve their health. It's being used in a lot, so that because we've already screwed up the future for them, that we use this money that's trying to drain some of the carbon out of the atmosphere, and we give it to those kids so that we prepare them for this really challenging future. And I thought that was really interesting because it's a good selling point. The kids, you know, we always talk about the children. We never really invest in them. But it might be an interesting way of packaging a carbon tax. So, Fred, that was my answer to you. There are many ways of approaching this, and there are many ways of using the revenues from this. And just because you say carbon tax, you can't make an assumption that they're all cookie cutter and the same. I think what we definitely know, however, is that we have to deal with a changing environment, and that is problematic. So I'm going to hope that we grab our guests, and we are grabbing our guests now. So everyone, today is our Rethink the Week. We're waiting for Dean Spiliotis, who's probably going to show up in about 6 or 7 minutes. Dean Spiliotis is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University, and comes in at around 10 minutes after the hour. But we are lucky to be able to grab some people by phone earlier, and we're going to grab them right now. Joining us from the great state of Iowa that has consumed the news cycle for the last 48 hours because of the Des Moines Register poll is Sean Sebastian. So, Sean, will you explain to my audience exactly how I would describe you? I described you as a sort of an organizer in Iowa, but there's so much more to Sean Sebastian than that. So please welcome to the program and give them like a 1 minute interview. And who are you?
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much. That's really flattering. So I am an organizer in Iowa with Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement, the largest community-based organization in Iowa. I'm also the organizing director for the Working Families Party, which is a left political party that's a national political party. And my previous job was working with the Fed Up campaign, where I was focused on monetary policy. So I've been at the intersection of economic policy, think tanks, community-based organizations, and left political organizing.
I think I want your life when I come back the next for my next life. I just, I mean, I love, I mean, the potential and the opportunity to intersect all those things. I never thought about that. I didn't even know that was possible when I was younger. So I'm in awe, and I'm grateful that you're joining us from Iowa, especially because tomorrow night is the last debate before the Iowa caucus, and everybody has been fretting about what's been happening and the sort of interesting changing landscape there. Also joining us on the phone is Mark Fernald. I've known Mark for decades. Mark is an attorney in the western part of the state. He is also a former state senator. He also was the Democratic nominee for governor. Both of us ran on that crazy idea of an income tax in New Hampshire because we believe in tax justice. So let me welcome Mark to the program. How are you, Mark?
I am fine. How are you?
I am great. I am great. So I'm going to start with something that maybe you don't know because I know it was just probably announced about 10 minutes ago, but I was given a heads up. So I know that the organization that you are with, Sean Sebastian, in Iowa endorsed Bernie Sanders. Am I correct?
That's right.
That's correct. All right. Well, I just found out that the SEIU in New Hampshire has just decided to also make an endorsement, and they have also endorsed Bernie Sanders. So that is the big State Employees Association in New Hampshire. That was happening right around noon today. So I just wanted to sort of bookend what was going on in Iowa with your organization with what is happening in New Hampshire today. Mark, there has been a lot of interest sort of coming out of what's happening in Iowa, and the Des Moines Register poll did something which is not surprising, but it gave Bernie sort of the first slot. But the first four candidates in that poll really have been sort of shifting back and forth. No, Pete's on first. No, Elizabeth's on first. No, Bernie's on first. So as you look at this sort of fluid landscape in Iowa, what I'm kind of curious is there's been a lot of talk about Bernie and Warren going after the same base. And apparently just recently in Iowa, there was some suggestion that perhaps Bernie was actually going after Elizabeth in a way everyone's been waiting for. But Bernie says, you know, I don't go after Elizabeth. You know, I don't go after opponents that way. That's not my style. But at some point in time, you do have to give people the rationale for why me and not her. So taking a look at these two candidates, how would you distinguish it? I know you're supporting Mayor Pete, so this is good because I'm not asking you to sort of choose between, you know, your two children. I'm asking you to sort of explain how you see the two candidates playing out differently.
I guess the answer I have given on that question, because it's been asked of me, is that I think that Elizabeth Warren is very articulate, a good explainer of our problems and her proposed solutions. Which are very similar to Bernie's, but I feel like she's a better version of Bernie, that she is better at communicating those issues. And not to say everyone agrees with me, but that's how I look at those two.
And I wanted you to say that because, again, you're in New Hampshire and you've been asked that question. So now, Sean, lucky you, your organization endorsed Bernie. How did they come to the conclusion, Bernie versus Elizabeth? Because I suspect that those were the two that were really sort of, you know, pulling at your heartstrings for where you wanted to go, given the progressive nature of your organization.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's also something that is really important to put at the forefront when we talk about this, because it's very easy to kind of like draw distinctions and gin up kind of conflict between them. But the fact is that among our base of very progressive people, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders were the top two. The people who liked Elizabeth Warren had Bernie as their second choice, and vice versa. People who liked Bernie had Elizabeth as their second choice. So there is just quite a bit of overlap. I think in the end, in Iowa in particular, what happened, I think a lot of it is about the relationships that Bernie has built over a long time, because he ran in 2016. Right. So he's been in deep relationship with our organization and our organization's key issues for a very long time. We're lucky, just like New Hampshire, to have a lot of access to these presidential candidates.
Exactly.
And so we gave the presidential candidates opportunities to come to our offices, to do an issue briefing, to do a tour of factory farms and their impact on rural communities. And Bernie and his team took us up on all of those opportunities. So they got a chance to kind of interact directly with our members, learn about the issues that were most important to us, and incorporate it into those policies. And Warren, definitely, we were able to do similar things to shape her policies as well, and our membership really appreciated that. But at the end of the day, it was Bernie and Bernie's team that put in more legwork to win the endorsement.
So joining us right now is Dean Spiliotis. Dean Spiliotis is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar from Southern New Hampshire University. You hear him regularly on New Hampshire Public Radio. He also has a blog, nhpoliticalcapital.com. So I want to welcome Dean to the program.
Hi, Arnie.
So, Dean, we're talking obviously about Elizabeth and Bernie. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I'm going to be actually asked by NBC News about the quote unquote conflict between the two of them. So, Dean, one of the things I saw was that Bernie said the difference between Elizabeth and myself, and he's not trashing her. He said, but the difference between Elizabeth and myself is that Elizabeth is a capitalist. So let's talk about this, because one of the things I think is so interesting is that he always refers to Norway and Sweden and Denmark and Finland. Last time I checked, those democratic socialist countries, they're capitalist too.
Yes.
And so that's what's so interesting, is that I'm not sure that either Elizabeth has talked about the Norwegian capitalists and the Swedish capitalists and the fact that IKEA is Swedish and everybody wants an IKEA in their town and not Sears. And the idea that as if there's a real sort of difference between the two of them, when you realize that a lot of the countries he's pointing to also embrace a form of capitalism. Dean?
Well, you know, part of the issue is that people throw around these words now to the point where the meaning gets blurred, the difference between socialism and democratic socialism and communism and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, in the end, it really comes down to how it is used as a campaign tactic, essentially.
Right.
So, you know, Bernie can make that distinction. You know, how that would play out in a general election, I don't know. My guess is Elizabeth Warren would still be accused of being a socialist.
They will.
Yeah, it's not really going to matter, right? So
exactly.
Part of it is just kind of intellectual discussion that I think is going to be lost in the general lost on people in the general. People are going to throw these terms around.
Well, let me
interchangeable.
I want to jump in
here.
Yes,
please, Mark. Please,
because
Mark.
I think the words matter more than maybe people think.
I totally agree with you. I totally agree.
I disagree.
I think that Bernie Sanders identifying himself as a socialist rather than a capitalist is a huge distinction. There are lots of people who pay really, really close attention to everything that's going on. You know, they're junkies like everybody who's on this call. But there are a lot of voters who don't spend that much time on it. And these labels and these, you know, sound bites and whatever all count. And I think, you know, Bernie labeling himself as socialist is a huge difference. I thought Elizabeth Warren labeling herself a capitalist was really smart. And I think part of the reason why I hear middle-of-the-road, sometimes Republican-voting people saying, I would never vote for Bernie Sanders, it's partly because of how he's labeled himself.
Okay, so, Sean, I'm going to bring this in. So I saw an article that said that Donald Trump has suddenly realized that Bernie might actually be the nominee. So now he's paying attention to Bernie Sanders. So one of the things I pointed out is that's right. And he is going to call Bernie Sanders a socialist. But he's going to call Mayor Pete a socialist. He's going to call Joe Biden a socialist. He's going to call Elizabeth Warren a socialist. Don't you think the difference, Sean, is that what Bernie will be able to do is, you're absolutely right. And this is how you spell socialist. So instead of running away from it, he is going to be in an interesting position to define the term in a way that I think will play out in places like Michigan.
So let me ask you this. Think it's a winning strategy for Democrats in the general election to carefully spell out socialism and why it's actually a good thing for the country?
Holy
cow.
Sean, I'm going to ask you. All right, Dean, go on, Sean. I would love to have you respond.
I didn't jump in before, but, you know, I understand Sean's point about, I think in some corners of the Democratic Party, these kinds of intellectual distinctions are important. The general election, it's not going to matter
at all.
Okay, so Sean, respond.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think, like, the, you know, the proof is really in the pudding, right? Like, Bernie is winning in Iowa, and I think the latest polls show him winning in New Hampshire. And I know that's not a general election strategy, but when you think about the general election, a lot of the same tactics that are being used in the primary will come into play, because when you ask people, do you think healthcare is a human right? Do you think the profit motive should be a part of whether or not someone who's gravely ill gets care or not? I think, like, most people understand and think that, like, healthcare is a human right. I think when you talk about climate change and when you talk about the scale of the problem that we're facing and how, you know, like what we're seeing all across the world and all across the country, do you think that that is something that necessitates a response that is on the scale of the New Deal or World War II, that this is an existential crisis and we shouldn't be waiting for market-driven solutions to decide whether or not we actually address the climate crisis? I think people are saying resoundingly, yes, we need to do that. So I think I fall somewhere in between where I think, like, the label socialist, like, it may come up, it may be something that some people in the intelligentsia care about, but ultimately it comes down to issues. And on those issues in particular, which are two of the biggest issues in Iowa that have been identified by the Des Moines Register as the two top issues among Iowa caucus goers, and some of the biggest issues that we're facing as Americans, I think, like, those ideas are kind of common sense, however you frame them.
I don't disagree. So I mean, Dean's rolling his eyes. So let me. I get to see him. I don't get to see you, Mark, or you, Sean. So as I'm looking at this, and I keep thinking, so what's Social Security? So what's public education? So when you begin to look at all those socialist policies that nobody wants to get rid of, then what you do is you expand on that and you begin to sort of say, so what is it that we need? And those socialist countries that do have IKEA and do have billionaires and do have rich people. So what you've been told is you can't have capitalism and be a socialist. But it turns out in these democratic socialist countries, not only can you have capitalism, but you don't go bankrupt when you get sick. You don't go into debt when you go to college. And you might actually be able to fight climate change. Sounds like a win-win-win to me. I'll become whatever that is. Now, Dean, how do you address that?
Well, I mean, I guess my issue is less with some of the policy prescriptions you're talking about and more with how that's presented in a general election. And, you know, you sort of know what the opposition is going to say. And, you know, I think, you know, for let's say hypothetically, and just to say with Bernie, I mean, this controversy that you mentioned briefly, you know, this is precarious for him because I heard him this morning saying that, you know, he has a big campaign. Sometimes people do things. He's not aware of it. This is the same thing that happened with Hillary Clinton in 2016, and there's going to if this kind of thing continues, there's going to be a lot of bad blood towards him for people who believe that he's kind of sandbagging the other candidates and then declaring, "Oh, it's a big campaign. I didn't know about it,
Let me go to Mark because Mark's supporting Mayor Pete. Yeah. Mayor Pete has been critical.
Yeah, I'm not supporting anyone here.
I capisce. I'm not saying that.
Yeah,
but what I am saying is this is an election, Mark. You have to make a choice, Mark. You have to distinguish yourself from other candidates, Mark. I remember when I ran for governor and when you ran for governor, I ran against the party chairman and the five-term congressman. Trust me, I distinguished myself between them. I didn't necessarily trash them a little bit, though. So, I mean, do people understand what elections are about and what choices are about? It's not a kumbaya, am I right, Mark?
Forgotten what the expression is, but, you know, it's not tiddlywinks.
Yeah, that's tiddlywinks.
In politics. You know, they're going to dust it up, and I think people expect that. And I think the bad blood argument that Dean was making, that will ring true with a few people, but not that many.
Yes.
I mean, if you want to talk about knives that hurt, Bernie spending months labeling Hillary a corporatist Democrat, a label that is thrown around in this cycle as well, is something that I think is very damaging to the Democratic Party, because the policy differences between Bernie and Pete and Amy and Liz and whatever is not that great. Mm-hmm. And I think throwing around as if we've got evil Democrats and good Democrats, that's really damaging.
Well, wait a second. Excuse me. Can I introduce you to Bill Clinton, the new Democrat, the corporatist Democrat? I mean, I hate to break it to you, Mark, but come on, you're in La La Land. I mean, why do you think she moved to New York? She didn't move to wherever he came from in Arkansas. There was a reason that she was called a corporatist Democrat, because I think people that weren't Bernie Sanders kind of looked at her as basically basically holding hands with Wall Street, being very accommodating to the financial community, coming from a new Democratic background. And a new Democratic background was the end of big government is over. You know, I mean, there's no question who deregulated derivatives. Her husband. You know, who got rid of Glass-Steagall? Her husband.
You know, let me come right back at you, Arnie.
Okay, come back at me.
Democrats earned a label in the 70s and into the 80s as being anti-business, which is to say they weren't willing to be called capitalists. And that definitely hurt the Democratic Party. So Clinton was trying to rebrand and say to business people, look, we are listening to you. We're not going to agree with you on everything, but we understand that we need to have a balance. We need to, you know, we need business. We need capitalism for the country, the economy to work and for people to be at work. But at the same time, we need social programs and a social safety net. And that doesn't make someone a corporatist, that is to say, in the pockets of the corporation, just to say you're listening to them, that you're just not.
All those Goldman Sachs in their administration. Anyway, I want to go there. So I know that you want to jump in, Sean, because one of the reasons I want to bring up this conversation is that we're not going to call them corporatist Democrats. We're going to call them more moderate, which is, I think, a more accurate interpretation. But explain to me what's going on with Mayor Pete in Iowa, because Pete Buttigieg was doing incredibly well. And for some reason, we've seen his numbers go down dramatically. What do you attribute that to?
So it's a good question, and I think a lot of it has to do with the question that we're bringing up now, which is the direction of the Democratic Party. And like you astutely put it, that started with the New Democrats, like, allying with Wall Street. And what we saw there was that, you know, we saw devastating welfare reform. We saw mass incarceration. We saw the deregulation of Wall Street all under a Democratic president. And the question is, can the deep crises that we're facing when it comes to economic inequality, when it comes to the climate crisis, when it comes to war and peace, these huge issues, like, can we continue with a corporate approach, right? So, like, that's the battle that's happening in the Democratic Party right now. And I think one of the reasons that Pete fell very sharply is because, you know, he's been studiously been able to kind of talk on a very general level. I think, like, once it became clear that many of his backers are the billionaire class, right? Like, so his top policy advisor comes from Goldman Sachs. Sullivan and Cromwell, the law firm, and particularly the lawyer Raj Cohen, who funneled trillions of dollars to the banks, is one of Pete's big bundlers. And Pete actually returned that money because it was so toxic. But in addition to that, Sullivan and Cromwell's antitrust team has gone all in on Pete Buttigieg. And that antitrust team is the team that did the Bayer-Monsanto merger. And that Bayer-Monsanto merger has tripled seed prices in Iowa, has added to corporate concentration, which results in Iowa having one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country, but wages being flat for the last 40 years as they are across the country, as they have been across the country. But in Iowa, those wages are even lower than the national average and lower than other places. A lot of people say that's because of corporate concentration. A lot of people say that's because of lax antitrust rules. So I think people, especially at the last debate, you know, Pete got hammered for the wine cave, right? Yeah. And like, as you dig deeper, there's some very kind of specific bad folks, right? Like, the 2008 financial crash, although the headline unemployment numbers have recovered and are at record lows, wages are still incredibly low. And in rural America, and that's a lot of Iowa, job growth has not recovered and has stayed low. So you're talking about the people who have done some of the most harm to Iowans specifically going all in and backing Mayor Pete.
Mark, I wanted you to hear what Sean said, and I want to turn to Dean because we have to go to a break. But Dean, what's so interesting is, let's remember how many people participate in caucuses. It's a very small number. Sean is able to do with an organization that obviously is spread out across Iowa, that's very involved in the grassroots, having made the decision to embrace Bernie, is that not only does Bernie have a message that apparently resonates candidates in Iowa, but now you have people all across Iowa who are able to do exactly what Sean did and be able to distinguish the candidates in a way that is Iowa-specific. So you can like Mayor Pete on the stage, but then when you have someone canvassing you in Iowa, and it's a small group of people sure. that are going to show up, this is one of the reasons why I think Pete saw his numbers drop and why organization in Iowa is so damn important, because we're not talking about a state the size of California. Basically, the number of people that are going to participate is like the size of a large city, but not necessarily anything more significant than that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it also has implications for your ability to when you start to reapportion the caucus goers. If people don't meet the respective thresholds, then you want to have made the case that you know, if Bernie's not your first choice, in the case of someone starting supporting Bernie, then you know he'll become your first choice if it has to, you have to go
exactly,
to your second choice.
Exactly. It's going to be but I just want people to hear what Sean said, because Mark, I think what's so amazing about that is you and I may not have been able to sort of go through that litany of issues vis-a-vis Mayor Pete, but can you imagine if there are people like Sean all over canvassing all over Iowa, knocking on every door and making the connection not just to wealthy bundlers, but to how that affected Iowa? That, I think, is one of the reasons why I think Mayor Pete's numbers began to tank. Tomorrow night's going to be fascinating. It's our Rethink the Week. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. We're going to do a little labor history next, and we'll be back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1873. That was the day the single most deadly incident of the Reconstruction era occurred, known as the Colfax Massacre. As many as 150 black Republicans in Colfax, Louisiana, were slaughtered by white supremacists determined to destroy advances made by the formerly enslaved. Results of the 1872 gubernatorial election in Louisiana had been hotly contested. President Ulysses S. Grant ordered federal troops in to support the Republican winner, William Pitt Kellogg. A number of black radical Republicans had also won or retained local and state political positions. William Ward, a black Civil War veteran and militia leader, had won a seat in the state legislature. By the beginning of April, he and others were being threatened with attacks on the Grant Parish Courthouse in Colfax. And lynchings by defeated white Southern Democrats. Desperate for backup, Ward and others left for New Orleans to appeal for federal reinforcement. On the Holy Easter Sunday, ex-Confederates, Klansmen, and Democrats rode into Colfax armed with guns, rifles, knives, and a cannon. 150 black Republicans were ready to defend their courthouse. Fighting raged on for hours, but eventually black Republicans were forced to retreat and then were massacred. 97 whites were indicted on federal conspiracy charges under the 1870 Enforcement Act, designed to enforce civil rights and root out Klan terror. The case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court and resulted in the ruling United States versus Cruikshank, which essentially gutted the Enforcement Act. Of the 97 indicted, 9 were tried, and 3 were initially found guilty. The Cruikshank ruling eventually overturned their convictions and effectively marked the legal end of Reconstruction. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When the forecast calls for heavy rain, Helen Lekovich braces for the worst.
You don't go to sleep, you set your alarm, you continuously wake up. You get in your car in the middle of the night, you drive to see what is it doing, how close is it coming.
Lekovich lives in Midlothian, Illinois, downhill from a small creek that overflows during heavy rain. Fast rushing water inundates yards and homes.
It's terrifying. At one point it heaved my 3-car garage off the ground. It has heaved all of my landscaping, the bushes.
She says Midlothian has always had a problem with flooding, but it's gotten much worse in recent years.
We have extreme fast rains. We're getting 1- and 2-inch rains in an hour and a half. That's something that didn't used to happen.
Lekovich leads a group of residents fighting for flood relief. Largely because of their efforts, the region's Stormwater Management Agency is now spending about $8 million to widen the creek channel, enlarge culverts, and divert stormwater. It's progress. But Lekovich says it does not fully solve the problem. Many homes could still flood when the most intense rains strike. So as weather grows more extreme, the risks remain. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
to just keep playing this. I'm sorry. All right. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Buster Poindexter's Hot, Hot, Hot. Am I right? Very good. And joining us for our Rethink the Week in studio is Dean Spiliotis, a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. Joining us by phone is Mark Fernald, a former New Hampshire state senator, a two-time candidate for governor in the state of New Hampshire, and a endorser and supporter of Mayor Pete. I want to make sure that's out there. Joining us also from the great state of Iowa is Sean Sebastian. He is with the Working Families Party, CCI Action. He was formerly the director of Fed Up, and my understanding is CCI Action has endorsed Bernie Sanders. Am I correct?
That is correct.
That is correct. So this, so the hot, hot, hot. Let me just say something, Dean. I was thinking hot, hot, hot meant we should be talking about Australia. But I think we're going to talk about Australia at the end of the show. We're going to be talking about Mayor Bloomberg. Because Michael Bloomberg is making it hot, hot, hot. And the reason he's making it hot, hot, hot is that he is probably committed to spending at least, I think, $1 billion. I think he will get through the billion. And he is much richer, as you pointed out, than the faux billionaire Donald Trump. Show me your taxes, Donald. I think Michael Bloomberg's comment the other day that he will support any Democratic nominee for president, even a Bernie and Elizabeth, is interesting, and that all the money that he is spending, I don't know if he can do this legally, but that he will continue to sort of invest in whoever the Democratic nominee is through the November election. How is Michael Bloomberg, Dean Spiliotis, changing this conversation? Because I think his strategy of running for president and not just spending his billions on good causes like getting, you know, young people involved in the vote or climate change or gun control. I think he was smart to run for president. But I would love to sort of get your reaction.
Yeah, it's interesting. People who were very upset with him for spending his hundreds of millions on running seem a lot happier with him now that he said that he'll spend $1 billion on whoever the nominee is and keep his entire 500-person team on it all the way through November. So, you know, his strategy is a little unusual. You know, he's basically betting that coming out of those first four contests, there'll be enough of a split or enough of a kind of an unclear picture that we can get to Super Tuesday or even the next set of contests a week or so later. And that, you know, if this gets drawn out, there may be some opportunity for him by the time we get to the convention. You know, it's a bit of a long shot. But he, you know, when you have that kind of money,
you can also
make yourself part of the conversation. Yeah, doesn't mean he's going to get the nomination. But look at Tom Steyer. Steyer has spent, what, 60 million, and he qualified for the debate.
Came in second in South Carolina. So, Mark, I want to turn to you because I was talking about Michael Bloomberg and his strategy. And someone used a term that you will understand because you're an attorney. And the term was that by his decision to run for president, it gave him standing. Which I thought was an interesting way of framing it, because I think by doing that, he is already running a national campaign. He is not running a campaign really against the other candidates running for president. He is running a campaign against, quote unquote, him, and in this case, Donald Trump. And I think that was a smart strategy, not necessarily because it will produce a win for Michael Bloomberg. It could, but that it's doing for the Democratic Party what they can't do right now because they are in the primary caucus situation where everyone is sort of trying to distinguish themselves from the top now six or seven, and they're not offering a national sort of more Democratic message. But that's what Michael Bloomberg is actually able to do right out of the get-go. Mark?
Yeah. I mean, he's got the money to do it, and he's advertising in states where other candidates aren't doing that. And I think he is perhaps targeting voters who are pretty reliable Democratic primary voters, but don't get really involved in it, maybe don't go to events,
exactly.
Might watch debates, might not, but they're going to vote. And the more low-involvement primary voters, they're not going to be, you know, fire-breathing for any one candidate. Mm-hmm. And they're probably looking for somebody more moderate. Just sort of going back through history, when Bill Bradley ran for president against Al Gore had the establishment, and it seemed like Bill Bradley had everybody else. But he didn't win.
Right.
You know, it was all these sort of silent, lower-involvement, quiet people who voted for Gore. And then that repeated when in the primary when Obama was against Clinton. Mm-hmm. And all the activists, all the energy was with Obama, but he didn't win.
Obama did win.
Not in New Hampshire.
Oh, well, but in New Hampshire, let's be honest here. The Clintons have been sleeping here since 1991. I mean, so the relationship that we had between the Clintons and the New Hampshire Democrats was very interesting. And to compare it to the Gore-Bradley thing, I hate to break it to you, but the reason why Al Gore won, and I'll use my husband as an example, my husband went into the voting booth that night and tried to decide whether he was going to vote for John McCain or Bill Bradley. Because he was an undeclared. Mm. And he thought that somehow he needed to send a stronger message, and therefore he was going to send it with John McCain. John McCain got more votes than any Republican had ever gotten in history. He got more independent votes than any Republican in history. And if those independents had gone the other way, Bill Bradley could have beaten Al Gore. But McCain really was the sucking sound in 2000. But let me go to Sean Sebastian, because Sean, as we're sort of looking at this story moving in, what were we talking about? Mike Bloomberg. Do you know where Mike Bloomberg ran his first sort of bus tour? Do you know where he did, Sean Sebastian?
No, I didn't. I do not know where.
So this is actually very important. His first bus tour, where he was sort of traveling all over the state, took place in Texas. In Texas. That beyond interesting. Because we cover Texas every week. We're on KPFT in Houston, but we have a fabulous talker named Scott Braddock, who I recommend you should actually fly to Iowa to have him talk to you, because he's just wicked smart. And he's known as the dean of the Austin Press Corps. And Scott has taught us a lot about Texas. But, you know, a year and a half ago, he would never have said that Texas would have gone purple, even after Beto's, you know, very close race against Ted Cruz. But in the last year, Texas has really begun to shift. We saw a huge shift with Beto because of what he did with Ted Cruz. We saw a shift in what got elected despite the fact that Ted won, because Beto had coattails. And a lot of progressive and Democrats won in a state that historically had never seen those kind of numbers. And then we know there's a changing demographic in Texas. And that changing demographic is really pointing in the direction of the Democratic Party. But the other thing that's also happening is the Republican Party is beginning to eat their young. And the Speaker of the House and the Republican Speaker of the House has had to step aside because of this whole controversy that he created himself. So I said, and Scott has said, that there is the potential for Texas to go purple or even blue, which is shocking, in 2020. And Sean, you and I both know that if Texas turns blue, that changes the country forever. It really does, because of what happens in the Electoral College, because of the raw numbers of what Texas represents. So Michael Bloomberg's decision to do that, I think, is fascinating. How do you, as an economic justice, economic progressive, take a look at what Michael Bloomberg is doing, and how do you digest it or embrace it?
So, you know, unfortunately, Arnie, I don't really I don't have the same kind of rosy picture of Mike Bloomberg's motives here that I think you do.
Okay.
Because I think, like, one of the things that's really disturbing about this is that, you know, like, this is a small percentage of Mike Bloomberg's money and Tom Steyer's money. And what these two people are doing is showing every billionaire, like, how much a certain amount of money can get you on the map and in the polls, and particularly in a race where if Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren win, and like right now they're both in the lead in Iowa and set to kind of keep gaining momentum,
right.
These people like Mike Bloomberg and Jeff Bezos have billions of dollars to lose, right? So making a bet on the presidential, even if you can get a few delegates in a four-way race, Mike Bloomberg can potentially hold some delegates, and like I think that's ultimately his play. His play is not about winning the race. His play is about trying to see how much money you can spend to get a certain number of delegates that hopefully will get to a point where he can go into a brokered convention and make sure that he can protect his wealth from the aggressive wealth taxes that Sanders and Warren are suggesting. And to me, ultimately, despite the fact that he has made this promise about giving $1 billion to the eventual nominee, he's got billions of dollars to make sure that an eventual nominee isn't someone that's going to significantly decrease his wealth. And to me, ultimately, on balance, that's very dangerous.
So, and of course, what we can't forget, Dean Spiliotis, I believe back in, I think it was March of 2019, Jeff Bezos calls Michael Bloomberg, Jeff Bezos, the richest guy on the planet, calls Michael Bloomberg the eighth richest guy, I think, at least in the United States, if not on the planet, and says, have you thought about running for president? And right there, when you're combining the billions of Bezos and the fact that Bezos owns the Washington Post, everyone, and then you combine the billions of Michael Bloomberg, Dean Spiliotis, who owns Bloomberg News, not only do these guys have billions with them, but look at what they own, whatever's left of journalism in America. It's really kind of shocking. And that's why playing this out, as you hear Sean saying, is really so different. Because it isn't just about how much money a billionaire has to spend. These are billionaires with news organizations to basically sort of mirror them or give them a platform.
Mm-hmm. It's potentially very complicated. What's interesting is going back 10 plus years now, you look at a lot of the campaign finance decisions coming out of the Supreme Court, and you kind of knew we were headed in this direction.
Right.
That the more you equate money with free speech, the more likely you are with people who have a lot of money to use that to have an impact on the process. You know, what Bloomberg's exact motives are, whether it's purely to protect his own wealth, as Sean is suggesting, or some other means of having an impact on the public discourse and policy, I'm not sure, but certainly you see the potential there. And we're seeing with both him and Steyer, who are the money is giving them some progress. Is it enough to get the nomination? Probably not. But it may, as I suggested earlier, it may be similar to what Sean was suggesting, to be able to wield some sort of delegate-based power at the convention.
Let me just say something, because I want to go back to how Donald Trump won the race. And while Donald Trump has claimed to be a billionaire, he never had to spend billions. But he kind of got billions for nothing. And that was because he was the ratings god. And so when you look at the amount of free media Donald Trump got, Mark, compared to everybody else combined, Donald Trump was able to acquire a tremendous presence.
Could I add one thing, Arnie, because you may not even remember this. You were in a series by the Huffington Post back in 2016, by Scott Conroy.
Yep.
And there's this great, great quote you have in there where you talk about the other Republican candidates opening up the door to the family living room.
Yep.
And Donald Trump is already there.
Yes.
Because of the television show.
Because of The Apprentice.
Yeah, The Apprentice.
Exactly.
Right.
That was a great comment. So Donald Trump has actually also shown, before Michael Bloomberg, before Bezos, before Steyer, about what money can buy. And even though he technically didn't buy the ratings for CNN, he didn't buy the ratings on MSNBC, he didn't buy the ratings on Fox, in an interesting way, Michael Bloomberg could do the equivalent of buying those ratings, don't you think? Mark?
Absolutely. Having run against the wealthiest man in New Hampshire, I know something about big spending in politics.
That's right,
and there's
That's
no
right.
doubt about it that Steyer and Bloomberg have the money to buy a lot of points in a poll.
Yeah.
And get themselves on stages that other people who have worked harder and have more experience or whatever can't do. That's just the reality of how our politics works.
Yeah, I forgot you did. You ran against Benson. Oh, my God. Lucky you. You really got the short straw. Anyway, so let me turn to you, Sean. So tomorrow night is the debate. And because of what happened with Iran, it is going to change the conversation, I think, at the debate, because there's going to be a lot about foreign policy. What is your feel, being in Iowa, how that conversation has already started to shift, and how will voters in Iowa respond as they walk into the caucus in about a week or two later? I mean, I'm just kind of curious about how this, because this has not been, at the forefront of the conversation between the Democratic candidates. That will change dramatically. I said just the other night on a radio show that the conversation will be, how did you vote on the war in Iraq? And that's really, this will not be about Iran. It will be more about Iraq. So I'm sort of curious what you're hearing, Sean.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, because so much of this march to war in Iran just echoes what we all experienced and what we all saw happening in a slow motion way in 2003. And I think in Iowa, I think this is another, you asked me a question about Mayor Pete's drop in the polls. I think everything happening in Iran may also contribute to that. And I'll get back. And I think it's basically ultimately because, like, you know, it kind of puts into focus, like, look, whatever happens in Congress, even if it's a split legislature, the foreign policy is one of the few areas where the president has kind of like executive authority and where their discretion, they have the widest discretion. And it's obviously very important. And putting the mayor of the fourth largest town of Indiana in charge of such a huge responsibility, I think people are thinking twice about it. I know that Mayor Pete has his own foreign policy experience from serving, but, you know, I think this is something where Pete's, like, stark lack of experience is really kind of putting that into sharp focus.
Well, I'm going to challenge, or go on, keep going, and then I'll
yeah. And then I think the other thing is that's really important about this is that, you know, like in 2008, Iowa kind of famously, unexpectedly chose Barack Obama. And one thing that we need to remember is at that time, you know, Hillary Clinton was the front runner, and the primary distinguishing factor that Obama used to distinguish himself from Hillary Clinton was the Iraq War. So these are many of the same voters who made an anti-war vote in 2008. And I think this the march to war in Iran is sparking all of those memories. And I think this is only to the, this is why, you know, John Kerry has been sent to Iowa to go around Iowa and kind of obscure Joe Biden's record on his votes for Iraq, because they know that it's a huge liability going into the caucuses.
Well, and so, Dean, I've referred to Mayor Pete as sort of a young Joe Biden. And what's interesting is that what I just heard from Sean is the lack of experience with Pete Buttigieg. And yet I'm looking at Joe Biden, who has reams and reams of experience, but that necessarily isn't an asset as you walk into the debate tomorrow night, because that experience might not necessarily be the solutions that actually made sense, because now we can sort of look back and say, was that vote right? Yeah, was that vote right? Was that vote right? And so you can say, I know everything. And then the question is, but what were your solutions, and were they the right solutions for the country or the world?
Yeah, well, you know, and there's a reason why we've had other than Barack Obama, presidents who are first and foremost members of Congress over the last 40, 50 years. Typically, it's been governors with a few exceptions. You know, and Trump is kind of the ultimate outsider, or no legislative track record, no decision-making record that at least we're able to see. I mean, obviously, their financial decisions can be scrutinized to the extent possible. You know, that's particularly, I think, this situation in Iran really has highlighted that dimension of the race. You know, Biden's going to argue he has the experience and the foreign policy decision making.
He knows all the leaders,
cred, all that stuff. He's going to make all those arguments, and Bernie's going to argue, as he did with Hillary Clinton, that's precisely the problem, and pick apart the decisions. You know, Mayor Pete is just kind of trying to use, to the extent he can, his time in the Naval Reserves as the Naval Intelligence. You know, you see the ad that he's running this week. The first frame is him in fatigues with a rifle.
Right.
So he's trying to capitalize on that. And in an interesting way, Tulsi Gabbard is using it to make a different point. But nonetheless, it's to be expected.
So, Mark, I'm thinking about this Iran thing, and I'm thinking also about the fact that I feel like we're even now more alone than when we pulled out of the nuclear deal. And that is that it's all of the Europeans. It's a lot of countries in the Middle East who are terrified, except for Israel, because of course he called Bibi first. But it also gives Russia a really interesting place in this conversation, because they are very close to the Iranians here. It turns out that they have now more in common with the Europeans, who are absolutely apoplectic about this. So how is Donald Trump going to play this out from a foreign policy perspective when I feel like we're even now more alone, even when you look at his relationship with Putin, because Putin's going to be the great negotiator, and he's not going to be negotiating with us. He's going to be negotiating with the Europeans and the Iranians.
You know, I have no idea how Trump is going to do whatever, and I don't think anyone ever knows. I mean, the guy shooting from the hip is, you know, putting it mildly, and that's true every day of the week with Trump, including Twitter Saturdays and Twitter Sundays. But let me go back just for a second to, you know, how this all plays out in the coming 4 weeks. When Barack Obama ran for president, he had a pretty thin resume.
Yes,
and we nominated him, and then we elected him because we thought he could do the job. And just speaking from my guy, I think a lot of people look at Pete Buttigieg and they see someone who's smart and energetic and inquisitive, and he can do the job. He's got good judgment. And I also will say, and this is more anecdote than data, but I've been out canvassing for Pete Buttigieg, and they're sending me out to see undecided voters. But the thing that's on everybody's mind, as it has been for 12 months, is who can beat Donald Trump? And a lot of people say to me, if we pick someone to the far left, Liz or Bernie, is that more of a risk? And there's a lot of that thinking out there, even though the Bernie and Elizabeth people don't want to admit it. And there are a lot of people who have watched Joe Biden in the debates. Last debate, I think he did well. The five before that, not so good.
Not so good. Exactly, exactly. So, Sean, we only have a few minutes left, and I'm listening to this conversation. It is interesting. I mean, what is electability in 2020? I mean, when you realize, and I said this, that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump going into the 2016 election, I think it was Gallup. It's either Gallup or Pew. I forget. But one of the groups that have been polling forever, all right? They were polling on sort of the sense of negativism of candidates as they're going into their election. The highest negatives ever of any two candidates running for president occurred in 2016. Donald Trump had the highest negatives ever, and Hillary Clinton had the second highest negatives ever. So when we try to figure out what is electability, we ended up electing, in part because of the Electoral College, the most despised, disliked human being ever going into a presidential campaign. So I think this electability thing is so hard to define, Sean.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. And I think, like, especially how polarized things are now, you know, I think that the swing voter that we need to think about, to echo AOC, is the swing voter who went from not voting, who we turn to a voter. That's the swing voter we need to think about.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when I think about a person who is like, I will vote for Donald Trump, the person who puts children in cages, who gets into wars without even thinking about it, without notifying Congress completely illegally, the person who has been using our government as his personal piggy bank, unless a specific Democrat that I like will win the nomination, that person is just, like, I think, a thing of the past. Like, the swing voter is not a huge percentage of the electorate, and certainly not as big as the nearly 50% of people who didn't vote. So to me, the most important thing is, who is the candidate that can inspire all of those people who haven't voted to kind of come out in record numbers to get Trump out of office?
Okay.
And I think trying to triangulate to get to this kind of, this, to me, is somewhat mythical voter who is like, I will vote for a fascist unless a moderate comes up, you know, bubbles up from the nomination. I think it's just, it's misguided. I think we need to be thinking about.
Let me share. So let me just say something. My understanding is that Iowa voted that 17-year-olds can participate in the caucus if they turn 18 by the election in November. What are we seeing, Sean, before I let you go? Are we seeing any sense of enthusiasm with high school students that historically have never been able to participate? Will we see a surge of these young 17-year-olds showing up in caucuses? And the reason I ask that question is, if it's inclement weather, the 65-year-old may not show up, but the 17-year-old may show up. So tell me, are we seeing a spike within those young people? Because you were talking about the new voter. That's a very new voter.
Yeah, I absolutely think so. I think the numbers will bear it out on caucus day, right? But what I'm seeing on the ground is, particularly on the issue of climate and student debt, people, like young people, understand the stakes of this election are about the whole rest of their lives, and they're more motivated than I've ever seen young people before.
All right, this is The Attitude. This is Rethink the Week. I want to thank Sean Sebastian. I want to thank Mark Fernault. I want to thank Dean Spiliotis, and I want to thank my team in front of me. We end with Iowa Stubborn from The Music Man. Here we go.
Got a hotel in this town?
Yeah, it's not in town.
Can you tell me where it is?
Straight through town, turn right, come to the fork, go on from there.
Left or right?
Doesn't matter to me.
Thanks anyway.
Oh, there's nothing halfway. How about the Iowa way to treat you when we treat you?
Which we may not do at all.
There's an Iowa kind of special chip on the shoulder attitude we've never been without
that we recall.
We can be cold as a hole in thermometer in December if you ask about our weather in July.
And we're so by God stubborn we can stand touching noses for a week at a time and never see eye to eye.
But what the heck, you're welcome. Join us at the picnic. You can have your fill of all the food you bring yourself.
You really ought to give Iowa a try,
provided you are contrary.